I'm pleased to introduce to you James Garrison, who works on the Institute at the Institute of Philosophy in Vienna with me. So he's today is giving a talk on the topic of the forgotten rituals of order.
Yeah, and this is somewhat of an excerpt from my larger dissertation project, which I just finished. The dissertation is a reevaluation of Judith Butler's work, particularly the aesthetic implications in her more recent work on subject life, and the connection to the last lecture being that my approach is to look at, on a macro level, on a species level, at how a dynamic of foreclosure might take place, and how there are certain resources here for subject life and for the dilemmas that she lays out to be found in the first aesthetic technologies of politics, as I name them. So I'll just read from my paper in the interest of time. So, fire, fire, fire. This is what Prometheus brought. This is what defines humanity. This is what defines technology. This is what defines how the two are intertwined. We humans are human because we, having learned from Prometheus's transgressive gift, make fire. End of story. And I'm sorry for yelling fire in a crowded room. If only things were so simple. If only things were so simple. Indeed, ironies abound with the myth of Prometheus. The story's origin is based on forgetfulness of how humanity is to be defined and how it is to survive, and that Prometheus' other gift is itself forgotten, the flame being so transfixing. This is just part of contemporary phenomenologist Bernard Stiegler's view. He goes on to describe how the proliferation of what he calls technicization leads humanity to profound forgetfulness, where access to origins is lost, and remembering originary temporality occurs through attention not to organic or inorganic matter, but to how we organize matter, i.e. how techniques aesthetically temporalize existence. Contemporary Chinese philosopher Li Zihou provides a similar perspective. Following Confucius, he describes early sages elevating shamanic practice in the development of ritual, language, art, and music, and how this occurs in the proliferation of what Marx calls the humanization of nature and the naturalization of humanity, also from the 1844 manuscripts. This is to say that the ritual, discursive arts, are themselves material in how human society survives and thrives. Being material, ritual practice grows over time, but in a manner that covers itself over, almost like epical and geological strata, almost like sediment. Forgetfulness sets in as habits then sediment in the most basic use of religious, aesthetic, normative technologies, forming something akin to a Jungian collective unconsciousness in ways similar to, but crucially different from, Stiegler's view on forgetfulness. And so Stiegler and Lee together show how humanity has always had an aesthetic bearing rooted in the ritualized organization of labor and material, and why we work ceaselessly to forget this. The contention here is that Stiegler and Lee are describing the technology of social ritual in similar ways, and that this is connected with a very particular mode of forgetfulness. Simply put, we forget in order to survive, and we forget that we have forgotten, and this too is in order to survive. Well then, what has been forgotten? The myth of Prometheus may provide clues, if only indirectly and by way of allegory. In the lay and lazy retelling of the myth, Prometheus, so full of hubris, snatches fire from the sun, from the hearth Hephaestus, and brings it back to Earth for humans to enjoy, marking the birth of Homo sapiens as such. However, as Bernard Stiegler deftly argues, this profoundly and very ironically misses the point of the Promethean myth. Setting aside for the moment the more famous, but perhaps less conceptually rich telling of the myth in Aeschylus's Prometheus Bound, consider the version of the myth recounted in Plato's Protagoras. Then I'll quote this at length. There was once a time when the gods existed, but mortal races did not. When the time came for their appointed genesis, the gods molded them inside of the earth, blending together earth and fire and various compounds of earth and fire. when they are ready to bring them to light, the gods put Prometheus and Epimetheus in charge of decking them out and assigning to each its appropriate powers and abilities. To some, he assigned strength without quickness. The weaker ones he made quick. Some he armed. Others he left unarmed, but devised for them some other means for preserving themselves. He compensated for small size by issuing wings for flight or an underground habitat. Size was itself a safeguard for those he made large, and so on down the line, balancing his distribution, making adjustments, taking precautions against the possible extinction of any of the races. After supplying them with defenses against mutual destruction, he devised for them protection against the winter, against the weather. He clothed them with thick pelts and tough hides, capable of warding off winter storms, effective against heat, and serving also as a built-in natural bedding when they went to sleep. He also shod them, some with hooves, others with thick pads and bloodless skin. Then he provided them with forms of nourishment, plants for some, fruit from trees for others, roots for still others. And there were others, and there were some to whom he gave consumption of other animals as their sustenance. To some he gave the capacity for few births. To others, ravished by the former, he gave the capacity for multiple births, and so ensured the survival of their kind. But Epimetheus was not very wise, and he absentmindedly used up all the powers and abilities on the non-reasoning animals. He was left with the human race, completely unequipped. While he was floundering about at a loss, Prometheus arrived to inspect the distribution, and saw that while the other animals were well provided with everything, the human race was naked, unshod, unbedded, and unarmed, and was already the day on which all of them, human beings included, were destined to emerge from the earth into light. It was then that Prometheus, now desperate to find some means of survival for the human race, stole from Hephaestus and Athena wisdom in the practical arts together with fire, without which this kind of wisdom is effectively useless, and gave them outright to the human race. The wisdom it acquired was for staying alive. Wisdom was for living together in society. Political wisdom it did not acquire, because that was in the keeping of Zeus. Prometheus no longer had free access to the high citadel that is the house of Zeus, and besides this, the guards there were terrifying. But he did sneak into the building that Athena and Hephaestus shared to practice their arts. And he stole from Hephaestus the art of fire, and from Athena her arts, and he gave them to the human race. And it is from this origin that the resources human beings needed to stay alive came into being. Later, the story goes, Prometheus was charged with theft, all on account of Epimetheus. End of quote. As Stieler explains, Prometheus makes no sense by itself. Since what matters is the dyad with Epimetheus, and his own dual-layered forgetting, and reflecting upon that forgetting too late. And so he insists on not approaching the question concerning technology in solely Promethean terms. A certain mode of Epimethean forgetfulness is key. What does this mean for humanity, though? Stiegler's reading of the myth contends that, quote, humans are the forgotten ones. Humans only occur through their being forgotten. They only appear in disappearing. Why focus on this particular creation mythology, then? Why focus on this notion of forgetting and disappearing? Why and whence Prometheus? For Stiegler, the key point, independent of any particular Greek allegory, is the vulnerability of humans, described in the Promethean myth in terms of a lack of survival traits. This compels technology. This impels technology as prosthesis. This propels technological prosthesis outward, humanizing nature, but also crucially naturalizing humanity in the sense that Marx speaks about. The nature of techne, originally disposed to survival, and ultimately the temporality of being toward death, this eventually sediments over time. And this, for Stiegler, quote, bestows its identity upon the human individual, the accents of his speech, the style of his approach, the force of his gesture, the unity of his world. From this, end quote. From the sedimentation, tradition grows. Techne proliferates in technological traditions, which, being seduced by their own narratives, their own histories of progress, lead humans to start to care for a vulgar conception of time and vulgar technologies. So this is kind of following the beats of Heidegger. And this leaves any sense of originary temporality forgotten, the accumulated faults leaving humans in default of origin. It is important to note here, as Stiegler does, the need for both fire and the practical arts. And I'm lumping the practical arts and the political arts together in a way that's not quite as what happens with the myth, because I don't really believe in the Hephaestus, Athena, Zeus separation so much, for reasons that I lay out in my broader work. But in any case, the fire and the practical arts are needed. This is crucial because for Stiegler, the two emerge together in a dyad, but once again, the key is a certain type of forgetfulness born of excessive care for technology is prosthetic and external. Fire, fire, fire. Taking a broader view, Stiegler defines techniques in terms of savoir-faire, skill, pointing to politeness, elegance, and cuisine as techniques, and observing only with the latter, is there the kind of overtly material, productive technique that forms the traditional understanding of techniques, where an artisan serves as the efficient cause of poesis, an artisan also wielding fire in the case of Olaf cooking. The science of fire, rather than the fine arts of logos, mythos, and cultural rites, predominate in the common understanding of technology. And so, on yet another level, this leads humanity to a profound forgetfulness, a Promethean forgetfulness, where access to origins is lost due to the basic nature of humanity's technological prosthesis being external, building up and sedimenting as tradition, which thereby generates an illusion of succession and an inauthentic sense of time. For him, the only way to access authentic originary temporality is through attention neither to humanity's inner organic matter nor the world's external inorganic matter as such. Stiegler, addressing what he sees as shortcomings in Heidegger's account, vis-a-vis what he terms the dynamic of organization, maintains that this occurs through techniques that are themselves the constitutive organon of the interior and exterior, of the who and the what, of the subject and the object, of the technician and the material. With historical, cultural, and economic forces sedimenting and concealing the temporality of techniques, the interior, who, subject, technician, Aristotelian efficient cause becomes the star of a narrative where human subjects stand over objects and master more and more banal technology at the expense of authentic technique. And so Stiegler calls for what he terms a politics of memory, which would, quote, be nothing but a thinking of techniques, of the unthought, of the immemorial, that would take into consideration the reflexivity informing every orthothetic form, which means every exact and lossless form of recording, every lossless form of memory. So digital data is a good paradigm here. So we take into consideration the reflexivity of every orthothetic form insofar as it does nothing but call for reflection on the originary default of origin. Stiegler's book is a bit unwieldy, but this is my concise but somewhat dense statement of Stiegler's view, whereby the same forces that prompt Heidegger's being in time, the loss of the question of the meaning of being, are those that lead to the subject who overshadowing the object what, with the world set apart in parentheses from other egos who happen to meet inside in it. In Stiegler's view, something is lost when attention turns away from somewhat more subtle techniques like politeness and elegance and toward technical activities where the calculable evidence conceals, quote, the difference that Dasein is, with it being in fact technique that gives difference, that gives time. Stiegler holds that for humanity, tools are foresight. Prometheus is the foreseeing one. But lamentably, such foresight only happens through an original forgetfulness, which in the myth is that of Epimetheus. And for Stiegler, this is what marks the human condition as well. Even though the Promethean myth is somewhat culturally specific, Stiegler's point is that it is illustrative of a more thoroughgoing truth regarding the human condition, one which he just happens to approach through the lens of phenomenology. So stepping outside, and Marxism too, so stepping outside of Europe's Hellenic heritage, it might not be surprising to see other thinkers grappling with these issues in similar terms, albeit without this particular mythos. And so in thinking through the organization and cultivation of ritual technique, intercultural philosophy has a keen insight. Consider leading comparative philosopher Roger Ames and his reading of the early Chinese tradition, particularly as regards the figure of the sage. Ames argues that with Confucianism representing a language of Saussurean difference, the Confucian sage can be understood as having a particular skill and mastery of what Derrida goes on to call difference, the differentiation and deferral of meaning. Simply put, sages are creative when it comes to the techniques of ritual propriety, or Li. Now, Confucian philosophy has developed largely on its own terms, Li being very much one of them. And thus, it has its own vocabulary for dealing with many of these issues. So to what does this idea of ritual Li refer? Here I'm going to paraphrase a number of Confucian passages. Li means ritual propriety, broadly connoting everything from the subtly ritual habitual to grandiose formalities. Li is social grammar. Li, as Confucius puns, provides knowledge of where to stand. Li coordinates the where and when of social comings and goings. Li attends to gesture and comportment. Li describes how the players and the audience each take their various places and act just so at just the right time. Li forms a pair with yue, music, or more precisely, musical theater with connections to all arts. Li brings a convergence of bodily movement and moral excellence. Li is both an everyday social grammar and a social choreography. Li encompasses the ethical and aesthetic nature of self and self-cultivation. Li speaks to how language stands in society. Li connects the regulation of cultural expression and of society. Li sets up codes of difference and of deferral in the basic historical movement of discourse. Li leads to a fondness for and skill at making distinctions between leaders and subordinates, between the heavens and humanity, between the internal and the external. Li, as I said, addresses a great deal of what Derrida does with difference. Li expresses how the discursive climate defines how people parse the social field and live up to or down to social role archetypes. Li describes the body that stands. Li relates linguistically to ti, the corpus, with a sense surpassing a simple physical matter, pointing to the dynamic, ongoing arrangement of bodies, plural. Li grounds self-cultivation. Li addresses the role of ritual in physical growth, coordination, and habituation. Li works in relational processes. Li thus deals with both individual human bodies and common bodies politic. Li provides a knowledge of when to make a stand. Li conditions social relations. Li establishes bounds and bidirectional demands between ruler and advisor, parent and child. Li refers to a ritual-based sense of appropriateness, including knowing when and how to call out an inappropriate failure to live up to a name or role, the basis of Confucian ethics. In sum, Li points to something very much like the Promethean practical arts. And it is here that an element of myth operates in the Chinese account, and in the account that Li Zihou advances, his name being a different character than Li, this ritual term. However, unlike with Prometheus, the Chinese version places the invention of ritual squarely within the human realm. There exists a long tradition within Confucianism ascribing the establishment of language, music, and social order to mythohistorical sages like the much lauded Yao. And so, Li Zihou observes, Chinese sages transformed and rationalized the power of the shamans into rites and rituals, and interpreted these powers as manifested in music and poetry to be constructive. Western scholars consider the powers of the muses attractive and powerful, but whimsical, and a threat to humans' most treasured faculty, reason. And so, the practical arts, so overlooked in post-Promethean notions of techne, according to Stiegler, here take center stage. Working with the Confucian sages' employment of ritual and bodily self-cultivation, Li casts the sage as an exemplar figure for understanding the proliferation of the dual processes that Marx calls the humanization of nature and the naturalization of humanity, where, in a manner similar to Stiegler's description, collective unconsciousness accrues and develops in this material operation of ritual. Li does not speak about forgetfulness per se. He ends up advancing something similar to, but with crucial divergences from, Stiegler's account of forgetfulness. Li Zihou, here advancing a novel reading of the Confucian position taken by the classical sage Mencius, maintains that humans naturally excel at artifice. We naturally are artificial. We excel at the art and craft of building society and nature in the deployment of labor and material. So it's not any sort of moral goodness, rather that we're the kinds of people that build society and build rituals. That's the kind of beings we are. He writes, For example, rhythm derives from basic laws extracted and homogenized by the various productive activities of living. In short, the different formal structures, various proportions, balance, rhythm, and orders, which constitute the laws of formal beauty, were discovered, developed, and comprehended first by the labors of human beings as they were made and used tools. And it is in this regard that Lee sees labor and the organization of labor as primarily aesthetic, for as he writes, quote, aesthetic experience arose first from daily labor. It is the feeling of form combining with the feeling of success as the laboring skill harmonizes with the rhythms of nature. Here, Lee speaks of subjectality, and this neologism, and this is what I'm pairing with subjectivation in a certain sense, is the macro level accompaniment to micro level, individual level subjectivation. So he speaks of subjectality, and this neologism speaks to the historical roots of subject life and the use of collective cultural psychology as a tool to define human society. It's the term that he uses to describe ritual's formative role in human social life and its artful use as a tool for human survival. Briefly, Lee uses notion of humanization of nature and naturalization of humanity to explain how shamanistic art, music, and rituals were tools for social cohesion operating in the early material economy of human survival. Moving forward, historically, Lee Tzu-ho sees Confucianism as being particularly apt, but not exclusively so, at describing and formalizing the cultural psychological edifice sedimented in human rationality, where with sedimentation he means, quote, human nature, which is a cultural psychological construction of uniquely human capabilities, was formed from the historical processes of using tools, social interactions, and the rituals of shamanism. What is human has been sedimented into individuals, the rational into the sensuous, and the social into the natural. Simultaneously, the humanizing of the animal sensory organs of primitive beings and the natural psychological structures acquired the qualities of human nature. And so, working in terms of the sedimentation of ritual, discursive and bodily practice, Lee turns to Kant and Marx in reconsidering the Confucian framework of, quote, being inspired by poetry, taking a stand with Li ritual, and finding perfection in music, to describe how tools like ritual artifice form humanity's superbiological body, thus allowing for labor on an object, on a noumenal humanity, which he casts as being akin to Jung's collective unconsciousness. And this is, for Lee, provides an aesthetically structured source of internal freedom. And it's here that something like the language of forgetting enters the picture, albeit in terms of Jungian archetypes, of mytho-historical figures in the vein of Ya, and not in terms of phenomenological temporal schemas. However, Lee sees these Jungian archetypes and the development of collective unconsciousness primarily in terms of sedimentation, writing that, quote, the unconscious does not refer to dormant animal instinct, but to a kind of non-conscious condensation of sedimentation achieved through human effort. However, Lee ends up much like Stiegler wrestling with the issue of how early human technical development was a matter of survival and how it was very much oriented toward death. And it's here with death that despite the lack of an explicit phenomenological bearing on Lee's part, that those familiar questions of authenticity, techne, and time appear. Writing more generally on the topic of mortality within the Confucian tradition, Lee writes, the knowledge that life has significance and value allows the individual to face the end of life naturally and without terror or distress. This is the ideal toward life and death for which Confucian thinkers strove. What one grieves is not so much a death as the brevity of life. Time passes quickly and there's little time to grasp the value and significance of one's life. And so in the Confucian tradition, we find on the one hand this deep lamentation over the brevity and transience of life, and on the other hand, a serious sense of history and intense sense of mission. And it's these two terms, history and mission, that he's going to cash out in somewhat familiar terms, speaking of emotionalized time and in terms of attachment to existence that accrues in the course of humanity's historical development. Describing how, quote, through history, time accumulates an emotional experiential significance. This is the difference between time as an inner human sense and the idea of general objective spatialized time. Time becomes deeply entangled in the sensuous emotions of nostalgia, yearning for life, and attachment to existence. And almost done. How am I doing on time?
I'm none.
Okay.
But you may take 2 more minutes.
Okay. Okay, then I'll hurry up then. Anyways, what Li Zihou does with his account is looking at the authenticity in this mode of social artistry that we see with the sage, which means making conscious the forgotten sediment of collective unconsciousness. It points to authenticity being found in emotionalized time, where emotion emerges through a certain relationship to human mortality transacted through ritual techniques. And then the idea here is that the use of artistic, musical, quasi-religious rites lies at the base of such a collective unconsciousness and this forgotten sediment, and that turning attention to this to ritual and its material and bodily dimension makes sense. So it's at this juncture in my dissertation, I turn to bodily practice and the work of Richard Schusterman on some aesthetics, practices like yoga, tai chi, martial arts, etc., as a means of telling the story of the subject's emergence in ways that go past the narrative emergence of the single subject, so part of the dilemma laid out by Butler. In any case, this is what I want to say is a way of pursuing also Stiegler's idea of this politics of memory, pursuing it with the body in a certain way. And so despite the complexity of their works and their varying theoretical commitments, I want to say that there is a genuine convergence in how Stiegler and Lee frame the issue of how finer techniques with a ritual basis lie at the root of human life, with whatever scope or definition in the individual or in the species level, and how such techniques become covered over with the passage of time. Fire is supposed to be the representative avatar of technology, but the practical arts are at least as important. Perhaps more than the fire itself is the key. The key is how we organize around fire. It's how we organize labor and material over time with care for human finitude. It is about how humanity collectively survives and how we recognize each other and ourselves individually within the broad sweep of human progress. So the macro being a source of recognition in a certain sense. I end by saying that Li Zihou is a little bit more optimistic. He has a certain faith in this notion of forgetfulness. It's not such a problem. He has his framework of union, collective unconsciousness, and archetypes being resources. So he stands in some contrast to Stiegler here. They lay out a similar dynamic, but with different attitudes towards it. In any case, the idioms do differ, and perfect correspondence between these ideas remains elusive, as it should. They're not the same. Nonetheless, setting aside both the convergences and the contrasts, this conversation ultimately has great bearing on a topic that should be important to all. The forgetting of the truly important techniques at the base of being human, and the possibility of remembering how to become more and more human through artful ritual techniques. Thank you.